Well, only three of us showed up last week, and poor one of them who hasn't gotten with us yet today. I feel sorry for her because I think we were way over her head. So with Floyd and me, you can imagine what happened.
The recording was 2 hours, 45 minutes.
I'm waiting for it to be posted. I can't wait. That's right. We're waiting for Floyd to edit your 2 hour and 45 minute tens, hundreds, thousands, 600 in heaven, 300 below. It's
Oh, you've been listening, huh?
No, Floyd and I had a communication on it.
Oh.
And
I
I was
tried to get him
thinking
to
of,
join
although
last week.
so
We got
it's
to the bottom of the Babylonian version of the 666.
yes.
Yeah,
And
yeah.
I forgot to mention it to our resident expert on Revelation here at PUC, Ross Winkle. I saw him plenty today. I mean this week. I could have talked to him about it. But in Babylon, there are 600 Anunnaki gods who are the totality of the gods of the pantheon. And then there are gods that have numbers. Most gods have numbers, Babylonian numbers. You need to know that in mathematics, the Babylonian use base 60 instead of base 10. So you have 60 is Anu, 6 is Adad, the storm god, 666. And if you look at the storm god, I pulled out a book on the storm god. And I began to look at the conclusion because there was no way we were going to be able to read the whole book one afternoon. I looked at the conclusion and the kings. Adad and all the other storm gods were the very foundation of kingship and authority. So 666 is about the authority and power. That's its substance in Babylon. I've been holding this off my chest for years, or on my chest for years. That was the first time I ever shared it.
Well, whoever that third person was truly blessed. Because most often it's read in the book is the number of a man, which has spawned countless speculation.
Well, you can refer to it as the number of a man, but that number can still mean power and authority.
Right.
And that is still the opposite of the lamb.
Exactly. This is kingly power. In fact, the book that I read out of to Floyd said kingly power. They actually used that term.
Well, if you think of Saul and you think of David, one had his thousands, the other had his 10,000. So definitely kingly power. So the numbers do match.
That was last week. We took a long time to get there because there was just a lot to work through to figure out all that.
But I What
was
part of
glad.
Revelation 13 sprung you into that?
But the last verse, which has the mark of the beast in it.
So does that mean 13 is actually, well, dare I say it,
In
completed?
the
Yeah.
bag? Yeah.
We have completely finished 13. Yes, we're ready for the
That's a
overview.
wrap, as they say.
I understand that language.
I'm looking forward to the overview since we have missed being with you guys with being out of cell phone range and company. And so are we doing the overview today?
Yes.
13. So good. I'll look forward to that. I've started listening to the ones I missed, but I haven't gotten through them all. So that'd be awesome.
Are we concluding with an overview of 13? Is that what I?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
I could wish that my Bible had 13 on one page or two pages that were open together, but I have to turn a page.
Mine just has a scrolling, so you know.
Well, that's the modern scroll, right?
Yes.
The Dead Sea.
Is that like having the seven seals?
I haven't had to break a seal. So
oh, okay. You have to break all seven in order to read it, right?
That's true.
Okay, so 13. Bill, I think it would do us good to read it again.
Okay. Do you want me to do the whole bit, or?
Why don't you read verses 1, 2, through, I should say, 10.
Okay, that's the first break mine gives me, too. Okay, this is Revelation 13, verses 1 through 10 from the Free Bible version. And the dragon stood on the seashore. Then I saw a beast rising out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 small crowns on his horns. And he had blasphemous names on his heads. The beast I saw looked like a leopard, but his feet looked like those of a bear, and his mouth looked like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power, his throne, and great authority. One of his heads seemed to have suffered a death blow, but this fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder at the beast, and they worshipped the dragon because he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, asking, "Who is like the beast? Who can defeat him?" He was given the ability to make great boasts and speak blasphemies, and he was also given the authority to do this for 42 months. As soon as he opened his mouth, he spoke blasphemies against God, insulting his character, his sanctuary, and those who live in heaven. The beast was given power to attack believers and defeat them, and he was also given authority over every people, tribe, language, and nation. Everybody living on earth will worship him, those whose names had not been written in the book of life, the book of life that belongs to the Lamb slain from the beginning of the world. If you have ears, listen. Anyone who goes into captivity will go into captivity. Anyone who has to die by the sword will die by the sword. This demonstrates the patient endurance and confidence in God of the believers.
Okay, Nancy, would you please read verses 11 to 18?
Well, and I'll continue in the Free Bible version. Then I saw another beast rising up from the earth. He had 2 horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. He imposed the same authority as the first beast on his behalf and made the earth and those who live there worship the first beast whose fatal wound had been healed. He performed great miracles, even bringing fire down from heaven to earth while people watched. He deceived those who live on the earth by the miracles he performed on behalf of the beast, ordering the people that they should make an image for the beast who had received the fatal sword wound but came back to life. He was permitted to breathe life into the image of the beast so that it could speak, ordering anyone who did not worship it put to death. He made everyone, whether weak or powerful, rich or poor, free or slave, receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. Nobody was permitted to buy or sell except those who had the mark, which was the name of the beast or the number of his name. Wisdom is needed here. Whoever has understanding should calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666.
I just want to give a different version reading of chapter 13, verse 6, part B. It blasphemed God's name and his dwelling place, that is those who dwell in heaven. God's name there would be his character.
Yeah, Jonathan has that as a note. Character,
oh, does he?
literally
Okay.
name, and his sanctuary, literally dwelling place. Or dwelling place. So thank you. Yes.
I have a version too, revision or note. Verse 10. Mine has the words, he that leadeth into captivity instead of goes.
So those who lead into captivity will go into captivity, and those who kill by the sword will be slain by the sword. Is that what it reads?
It's just that different word. This is a KJV that's prior to 42. So 1942.
Oh, okay.
Different revision.
And Jonathan's.
Oh, I've got go similar, but it's the Passion Translation. Verse 10 reads, for the one who leads others into captivity he goes. The one who kills others by the sword he will be put to death.
What is the background on the Passion Translation?
Good question. I'm not sure I can tell you. It is considered a translation. See, a Passion Translation is a copyright 2020 Passion and Fire Ministries. Let's see.
I'm just wondering who translated it.
Let's see. The Passion Translation. It only tells me the edition. Dunn Broad Street Publishing Group. Is that helpful?
I'm going to look it up, just see what I can find on it.
While you're doing that, Jonathan's note on 1310, he says there are two textual variants here. The text could also say that those who kill with the sword will themselves be killed with the sword, paralleling Matthew 26:52. However, in view of the next verse that encourages the believers to endure persecution rather than expecting retribution, the text has translated as the one preferred here, see Jeremiah 15:2.
I see. So it's a textual variant.
Jeremiah 15:2, did you say?
Yeah.
It's a textual variant.
Yeah. I can read the rest of this. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints.
So it does have, you know, Jonathan's choosing to render it in one variant, and the others are choosing to render it in the other variant. And both seem to have historical or intertextual support.
I can look up to see how much support those two variants have.
While we're looking at that, I just think it's interesting. So many other Bible passages come to mind that said, you know, when you choose this path, you ultimately will experience the consequence of choosing that path. And I know there's Psalms and Proverbs, I think, that I'm thinking of, where it talks about, you know, you're making a trap, but you're the one who's going to fall into the trap. You know, there's other references, and I don't know specific ones right now, but it talks about, you know, if you choose to live violently, oftentimes you die violently. That's the end consequence of that, of those choices. So I've always struggled a little bit with that, you know, but it makes sense to me that that ultimately the power grid that you're choosing to operate will affect your own life.
And I sit there and I go, well, I can appreciate both renderings.
Okay. I found them both in the Greek, and okay. There's a number 4, and it says verse 10b gives it a B rating, which this particular text of the Greek New Testament does, all variants. And it has Alexandrinus again about supporting it. And it has the Vulgate, Syriac, Irenaeus. It has weak support for that, but I think both have equally weak support. So here's what we have to do when we're looking at two variants. A variant is a alternate reading of the ancient text. In other words, you have more than one manuscript and you have two different readings.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have to do, this is called textual criticism. What you have to do is decide, okay, what is the most likely cause of this variant? And the one likely cause would be that one scribe decided that the other scribe was theologically in error, and he changed it to be more theologically viable. Another variant would be, it's a simple mistake of the verb, because the verbs are the same. And that's more probable than the theological one, where there's clearly a theological issue versus a grammatical issue, is Romans 8:28. In all things God works, or in all things, or all things work.
Mm-hmm.
So I would guess that it's probably just a simple mistake that a scribe made. And whether that scribe made a mistake because he was thinking theologically different or not, I don't know.
As far as the meaning goes, it would seem to at least be open that if someone is leading someone else into captivity,
mm-hmm.
they're doing it probably through deception. Because mm-hmm. to lead, you have to get people to follow you. You're not driving them. You're guiding them. You're giving them information deliberately to make them captive, probably without them realizing they're going to be captive until it's too late. So that would be deceptive. Mm-hmm. So, and that's in juxtaposition in the text with those who use force.
It's also different than the way that Messiah leads us as a shepherd. A shepherd leads right. from the rear.
Well, that's where I'm thinking. I can appreciate both tracks. One is on the tail of those who will force others to worship. They will mm-hmm. take people into captivity, or they will kill them. The end isn't good for them. Natural consequence. You don't have to have it as retribution. So then it's encouragement to remain patient and confident in God, so you're not like them. The other is to say, you may be taken into captivity and you may be killed by the sword. And that also is patient endurance for those who trust
God. It really doesn't make a whole lot of difference, does it? Except that theologically, we're more comfortable with the idea of leading into captivity, leading that person, making that person vulnerable to captivity.
I see it as two different ways of capturing people, and one is through leading them and the other is through direct force. And both of them are wrong, but whereas the other rendering, he who takes captive, that's by force, or he kills, that's by force, it's all force.
Mm-hmm.
But leading is sort of implies not force, but rather sophistry or deception or subtlety.
In other words, more choice involved in the matter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Deception, a person who leads by deception is himself deceived in a sense.
And Paul says something about deceiving and being deceived,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty much what the whole world's doing right now.
Well, I'm looking at thinking, okay, so those who trust God in whatever way they know the true God, right? God wants to be known. So, and we could say, whether one looking at as an overview, saying the dragon is now two people deep, pulling the strings of puppetry, if you will, giving everything to the first beast, and then a new beast arises. And so that's like a grandchild of the dragon, but has the full thing going on. And so the ones whose lives are written in the Lamb's Book of Life are implied that they don't, the sifting has happened or something like that. So in this context, I'm having a hard time saying anyone who, you know, demonstrating the patient endurance and confidence in God of the believers, they're no longer being led. They may be taken captive. They may be killed because they refuse to be led into captivity. They refuse to bow like Daniel's friends.
And we can be pretty sure that once they refuse, force will be attempted.
Right.
That because a person who leads by sophistry or deception is going to use force at some point if he's resisted.
Right.
Well, that, I guess, raises another question for me, because I've never been convinced that this reference to "here is the patience of the saints" is referring to the same people as in the previous verse. It's almost, to me, it's more like a contrast. Here you've got people who are deliberately guiding people into deception or captivity, or deliberately forcing them. But in contrast, here's the patience of the saints. For me, it's more of a contrast. It's not talking about the same people. It's talking about opposite people.
So this is a foreshadowing of what's going to happen in chapter 14.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that it really seems that it's more likely or more readable if we take it that some are leading rather than going into captivity. Because otherwise you're saying the same thing twice.
Yeah.
Which the Bible rarely does.
One thought here, a footnote, again from the Passion Translation, on that verse says, verse 13:10, this is one of the more difficult verses in Revelation to translate and interpret. With many variations found in differing manuscripts, it could also be translated, if anyone is destined for captivity, into captivity he goes. If anyone is destined to be killed by the sword he will be killed. This they all see also Jeremiah 15:2, which I haven't looked up, but destined is another interpretation they're throwing.
Predestination.
Right. I was thinking about that when I looked at the other translations, just comparing them. Many of them all use that destined word, which is kind of a Reformation type terminology. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I was looking at here in the, of course, this is through Strong's Greek, is the word for lead is the word synago, like the idea of synagogue or bringing out. But the idea that they mention here, I thought it's interesting, is to gather together or to draw together like fish that are drawn together, like being caught in a net. So they, like a school of fish coming, they're together maybe, and then they're trapped or they're kind of caught. And it's the idea also, the second meaning of being to assemble together, to collect. In other words, they're of like-mindedness. They're like thinking. They're coming together for that purpose.
If we were to use the word destined, which I'm not a fond of, but if we were to use that word, it could mean that their minds destined them. Their choices destined them.
Right.
That's true.
It seems to me, too, when you're looking at this in context, and it's just 8 is talking about this incredible worship that everybody on the earth is caught up in, those whose names are not written in the book of life, you know, and then again, this, what we've heard often, particularly in the messages to the churches, he who has ears to hear, let him hear, you know, so it's, if you have ears, listen. So it's this kind of warning. You know, and I, to me, it makes sense that God is challenging us not to get caught up in this power, coercive, forcing people to do things, you know, and going to the extreme of, I'm going to kill you if you don't agree with me. That, you know, it seems to me, again, that's God saying, this is beastly. This is not how I operate. Yes. Don't get caught up in that, because I think the most dangerous people in the world will be those people who believe God functions this way, which is, of course, what Revelation is supposed to help us understand. No, God is not this way. He's not this way. Look at the Lamb. He is so different than this beastly power. And, you know, I think that's what the world needs, is a revelation of this is not how God operates. He doesn't operate under force and power over. He always honors freedom of choice, and he's loving in that, even if that means people choose their own deaths by separating themselves from him ultimately.
In cooperation with what you've said, it's interesting that chapter 13, before it takes on the beast, that is from the Lamb and is so coercive, it reminds us of the Lamb. So that the dots are really connected for exactly what you've said, Nancy.
Well, I don't always feel connected when I'm saying what I'm saying, but hopefully I'm trying to understand that.
But you say it passionately, and I'm listening. I'm sorry if I started asking the question on the variance, but thank you for making that comment, Jean. That helped me regarding the error, the theological variable, and the mistake of the verbs. I've been thinking about that word leading, and thank you, Larry, for synago, which is interesting. But I have these visions that are popping in my head, and I'm thinking about the Lord being led out into the wilderness for temptation.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, boy, oh boy. And then when you said something about the predestination, which I don't like that word either, because I don't know, I'll be hard to find my backside in the corner. But the thing is, I always had a question about that, because it kind of felt like, are you telling me that he wasn't willing to go? That, you know, and I get the vision of the, you know, the war vision that we think, you know, where you're being led, you know, like, I think there's some commentary in the Bible regarding, you know, like through the nose or shackled, you know, like a prisoner kind of a feel. So I don't know.
I think there's more than one way to see destined. And I thought that what Larry pointed out is what synago could refer to, like a school of fish, being led into a trap, simply by circumstances or by someone manipulating.
Right. But are we all fish? I mean, again, you could look at that like mass hysteria formation, you know, that's.
Well, if there is going to be at some point, probably mass hysteria.
I think that's true, too. I see a school of fish also being like a school of fish. They're together naturally. Mm-hmm. And so they're being led and they go that direction. They're like, you know, like I don't know. It's like that type of idea.
You go with the crowd.
Yeah. You go with the crowd. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
I like the idea that you have a bunch of people who are like-minded who go.
Right.
In captivity because of what they believe.
Mm-hmm. Well, like a fish, you know, certain fish have a natural purpose to swim upstream just to be able to spawn and then die. So it's an interesting concept.
What seems to be the emphasis of this, and we're talking about the process of deceiving or killing or all that stuff, but I don't know what seems to be the main thrust of these two phrases is not what they're doing, but the destiny of those who choose to use those methods. It's not really talking about, it's just talking about the methods of saying, okay, if you are a person who either leads or captures or whatever, but if you're the person participating in this to other people, it's going to happen to you. If you're the person trying to get your way by killing other people, it's going to happen to you. That seems to be the emphasis here is
no matter how you happen, read it.
Yeah, it's going to happen to you. It's not trying to process and digest, you know, what are you doing? What's the problem? No, it's going to, whatever you're doing, it's going to happen to you.
That was kind of how I was trying to picture appreciating both, because both require patient endurance of those who trust God.
Exactly.
And so you could render it either way. And thank you, Floyd. I think that to me, you made it crystal clear. It really is saying more about the people who take captive. It may be, right? Because if you're the perpetrator of captivity or death, somebody's being taken captive and dying. Both require patient endurance of those who trust God because it's happening to them, regardless of which way.
Well, because those who trust in God are going against the flow.
Correct. Yeah.
So this is more or less an instructional verse for those that will come about this more than an accusation of those that are leading. Is that?
That's what
well,
I see.
In a way,
I see it that way too. So yeah. I almost was, I'm interested because this, I just happen to have this on one of the Bibles that I can find around this rickety, but it didn't have it in an italicized. And I almost thought in between 10 and 11, that's that last sentence may have been something that was in originally, but was added. I don't know.
I found myself wondering if this could be, you know, read theatrically. What kind of voice would this section have?
You give know, it a try.
Who is it? Who's it speaking to? You know, is it again? I think of God is always trying to say, you make this choice. These are the consequences you will reap. You reap what you sow. So what Floyd said, this, if you're leading into captivity, ultimately that shows that you're the ultimate prisoner of this distorted way of thinking. And if you're killing people who disagree with you, ultimately you will experience death, you know? But it's also, like you said, the flip side is people going through that. That's crummy. You're captive. You're being threatened with death. And, you know, that takes patient saying God ultimately is going to come through. So I'm going to hold on to my trust in God, no matter how many people are against me, how unpopular I am, you know, that all these terrible things are happening. I'm still going to trust God. So, but it would be interesting to see what voice this is. How this would be read by
Bill? Do you want me to read what you've said, or do you
I can. I just didn't want to lose the thought. So,
you chatted something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I see two things happening, and assuming because the doors aren't closed, it's telling a story in preparation, mm-hmm. and the preparation is twofold. One is a warning to those with a tendency towards violence, mm-hmm. manipulation, authority, and force. It's a warning and saying, be careful about going down that road.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. it's encouragement to those who believe they trust in God.
Well said.
I think I can definitely reflect mm-hmm. that as well, because when I read it, and it's been a while since we've read chapter 13, but when I read it up 2:10, and that's where it stood out on the leadeth me beside still waters. And I was looking at it from a standpoint, it almost seems like a break, because if I was somebody that had no understanding whatsoever or was reading Revelation like I am out loud for the first time, I those first nine, that first part of Revelation 13, you know, tying it back, if I had read Daniel 7, 8, whatever, I mean, I'd be kind of getting hot, you know what I mean? I'd be excited. And that last sentence for me kind of feels like the nice, cool, damp washcloth that says, you know, fear not, don't be afraid. It's okay, you know, it'll be okay. Let's go forward, you know? I don't know, just for me.
And I see the patient endurance contrast. It resonates with me of, or is it in Isaiah or someplace where it says, you know, this is our God. We have waited for him, in contrast to, well, the beast is doing it this way. Everybody else is doing it this way. And so it's saying, if you participate in leading into captivity, or if you participate in violence, then you're going to end up there. But if you wait for the Lamb God, and that means you got to forego doing all this stuff or fighting it or whatever, just don't go there. You know, stay over here. This is the patient endurance and the faith of Jesus, or whatever it says. So it's, I see this as a clear contrast. And it says, you know, he who has an ear to hear, pay attention.
So this is, I want to, living in the world. And so people who have our theological orientation and relational theology, I'm going to put it in that general term, are all over the map in political terms across the world. So living in the world is to live in a Babylonian system. Every nation, state, you know, big S state, you know, every nation. And so there's a challenge to participate in the world and not have. So I'm trying to articulate that there are people for whom force, fear, intimidation, guilt, and shame are at the back burner, but they have a position of power, if you will, authority in their country or somehow in the structure of that country. And they get threats from a lot of different ways. And how do you defend your nation? And there's a lot of ways, and we can look and say, in human history, war is always evil. No one wins. We win when there's peace. Economics grow, prosper, nations and people prosper in peace, not in war. So I think it's easy to say war is always evil. And yet wars happen.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the role believers play? And I think this is very diverse. Our faith tradition initially took a conscientious objector's position, but that you could be authorized to participate in a non-combative way. Those things have changed. That's fine. I'm just saying it's ivory tower to me to say, I'm going to go off and just be in my corner because I can hear that. And I'm just going to be I'm going to stand up for what I stand up for. And, you know, maybe I'm left of center and I want freedom but I'm a libertarian, right? So I want freedom for everybody. In what ways do I convey, and in the methods I convey, don't force, fear, intimidation, guilt, or shame? Because I can even say I don't believe in that and still give it. I guess that's the question I end up with.
Well, that's a difficult one because
it's a good one though.
I'm a pacifist, full-fledged pacifist. And when I used to teach ethics, I was usually the soloist in the room.
I bet.
My students did not agree.
I am staunchly anti-war.
I am too. Well, I am too, but
unfortunately, it's inevitable, isn't it?
This generation can't get that at all. To them, self-defense is number one. Whether it's personal self-defense with someone coming, breaking into your house, or whether it's personal self-defense on the battlefield.
And so I'm trying to teach myself to question things along the lines of, where am I scapegoating someone for coming into my home? Am I scapegoating another nation for some perceived abuse or real abuse? What are my methods, motives, and mindset for, because I could still.
Yeah, I hear you.
You can do what you can do. You can only do what you can do. I mean, if take an example, And I was reading this today. When we look at Saul, Saul was told to break down the fortresses, to break down the high places, to destroy these. And it seems like he did the best that he could. But yet at the end, in the case of the Witch of Endor, there still were those that were around. And I guess what it is it's a good endeavor. I would say, and again, you know, politics ruins everything. So when we get into it, but I what I understand is for those that, I'm just going to make this statement, and I know I'm going to get pushback, so don't feel bad about being a pacifist and being the only one, Gene, at all. I mean, you state what you state in your stand, and that's what it is. Anarchy is such that, for the most part, they need discipline. And I've always thought that's the reason why they need the law. And that's why we have a legalistic mindset. War is a legalistic mindset. There's no doubt about it. And if you listen to any of the information regarding what happened on this January 6th, and I'm not an orange man, I'm not a red man or a blue man or any of that, but you're going to see that there was chaos, and you're going to see there's anarchy, and there was a breakdown in communications and this, that, and the other thing. I think the important thing is just to state what we state as clear as we can. And for me, I should have asked for that in special prayer in the beginning, because I have a tendency to talk a little bit more parable. But at any rate, you can say what you can say, which is, I don't believe in war. And you show it in your walk by not carrying a gun. You know, in other words, you don't support those aspects of it. In their world, in this world, your money speaks. And your support in those areas speak. But your words are very important, too, to the people that you meet on the street, what we call neighbors. And in sharing your viewpoint, I mean, that's your choice to do that, too. And that's a good thing. That's what I'm trying to do in my new little town here.
So I would like to suggest that actually early Adventists were pacifists. Conscientious objection came much later.
Yeah.
They first dealt with war with the Civil War. And what they did support the war effort. They put in money, because they could do that to stay out of the battlefield. So they bought their ransom, as it were. I don't know what they would say now if those good people were resurrected. But I personally have chosen, by God's grace, to stay completely away from force and violence. Because the Bible, especially compared with the ancient Near East, makes it so very clear that God's power is not force and violence. And you could argue that because people died in the Old Testament, that God did use force and violence. But that's assuming that the Bible is literally, verbally inspired. And that we're not looking at human language in a way, because the Bible says that God sent leprosy into people's homes and that he did this, that, and the other thing that we don't believe he did today.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important that we read the entire Bible and let the Bible interpret itself. It's the same thing as forever and ever, which we're going to come to in chapter 14 soon.
Mm-hmm.
Adventists have long contended that that word does not mean endless existence. And we've used the Bible to prove that, Jude 7, for example. I think that's what we need to do with all those issues. But to me, creation, unlike all the other creations of ancient Near East, no violence.
And we can say, even with the atonement, it was not God perpetrating violence, but violence being perpetrated onto God.
Right.
So I'm going back to Revelation 13 and sort of how we got up to here. And maybe that brings us into 14. Is this is a, in a way, a passionate warning to those who trust and to those who maybe are sitting in the fence and to those who are not sitting on the fence and hate. That there's not an easy path forward. The patient endurance is that one day we may have to be willing to either die or be taken into captive to refuse the participation.
Right.
And maybe that's come and maybe it hasn't. And that's a personal journey question, I guess.
Well, let's return to an overview. Again, I like that the Lamb who is slain is set in reminder that this is the one we're to listen to. Before the beast arises, that is going to announce course and coercion and force and fear. So there's a lot of show and tell, a lot of fire coming down from heaven, a lot of miracles being exercised. At least it appears that they're being
exercised. By the beast on behalf of the dragon.
By the beast.
Mm-hmm.
And would not that mean involve the leading into captivity? Is deception through these signs and wonders?
Very possibly. I think here the concept of captivity could be through deception.
Repeatedly references to the beast or the beast powers or the dragon powers over and over. I mean, here in chapter 16, you know, it's like they're deliberately deceived. I mean, even in chapter 12, you know, he's the one who deceives the whole world.
I was just going to go there, yeah.
And over, it's deception, which that's what resonates here, I think, is that leading into captivity is deception. Or, and then a counterpart to that is just flat out threat of violence, you know, force.
Right. Which is leading through fear, which fear itself is a kind of deception.
It's almost the carrot stick approach. Well, here, let me seduce you. And if you refuse to be seduced, then, okay, I'm just directly going to force you.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can't make you, then bye-bye.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He uses all means possible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
So one clear overview point I think that we all have that we don't necessarily draw out is that the beast is the opposite of the Lamb.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In terms of character, in terms of activity, in terms of methodology, in terms of the way it relates to people. There's no relationship anybody can have with the beast except to submit.
Mm-hmm.
And I've personally come to believe that abject surrender is not a part of love.
That's a good way to put it.
That love always lets people be free.
Mm-hmm. Freedom.
By abject, you mean coerced?
Either that or made to feel like you have to surrender and you dutifully do because whether your heart is in it or not.
Under duress?
Mm-hmm. Under duress, some duress, yes.
Thank you.
And that contrast between the beast, which is this whole chapter is about, and his methods, and the next five verses, I'm now convinced that the chapter breaks entirely in the wrong spot. You know, the chapter needs to stop in verse 5 of the next chapter because that belongs in this chapter as the counterpart. to everything, or the contrast.
Good point. It's funny that the legalistic term that's acceptable in today's court of law is where you just said abject surrender is a word used if you claim that you're under duress, then the court has to stand in and they have to actually adjudicate it according to the law. It takes the emotional aspect out of it. I think taking the emotional aspect out of being a pacifist could be very, very difficult, because I think that that is something that I carried guns for a long time. And at one point in time, I said, I don't need these. I don't want these. I don't want anything to deal with that kind of situation. For me, I made that choice. I don't think it was a hard choice at all. And I don't regret it. And I don't have any fear that for whatever reason justified carrying those. Of course, I'm not in, I'm not in the same environment, but I think it's a choice to walk a certain way. And I think that choice is reiterated for me over and over again when I keep looking at here is the patience and the faith of the saints. This is a really wonderful statement at a time when it's just a beautiful thing that's being put in here.
I'd like to suggest that there is surrender to the sovereignty of love, but that surrender is very different than surrender to force. We are one to love and trust by the person who is the ultimate lover, whose very character is love, who is the source of love and life for the entire universe. And I'm practically quoting there. There's no love apart from him. Our love is from him, and it constantly needs support by him, because we're told to love our enemies. And that's not something we can do on our own. We can only love as we are loved and are supported by love.
That's interesting, because a comment was made this week to me, and it really rang true. He said that God needs us. He already loves our enemies. He's asking us to do it. And I was taken back by that. I kind of got
well. How can
and,
they
and you know what you just said? Well, you might say in the English translation, it was very provocative, Gene, because to provoke one another, we are called, and that is to love one another.
Yeah.
It's an interesting word.
The only way that we can love is through him. And as a result of that, that's the only way they can know that they are loved by him. Because a person who is hating you cannot see that they are loved. So we are the way to be able to break through. We don't. The Holy Spirit uses us to break through that stronghold and enable that person to sense they are loved.
Well, and that's a key phrase there, because if you grow up with a distorted understanding of love, you've totally missed everything. Like, I'm thinking that must be what happened in Lucifer's mind. He must have not really believed that love was other-centered thinking. He must have thought love is something that is selfish. I don't know.
I'll nuance that a little bit if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
I think he didn't believe it was possible to be real. He couldn't do it, so nobody could do it.
Interesting. Well, you brought up the point earlier that the lamb is not the beast. They're very different. And yet, in this, back to the overview, verse 11 seems to indicate that the beast wanted to look like the lamb. So he has two horns, look like a lamb. He does miracles and takes on authority and imposes the same authority, but he does it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
He tries to power over through miraculous deception, but it's all wannabe, not really authentic.
Or not so much wannabe, because he doesn't want to be like the real lamb. Right. He wants to create a different version of the lamb.
Yeah. Look alike.
In his image, but still call it a lamb.
Right. Good. Well said.
That's why the whole reinterpretation of the reasons for the cross have completely obliterated the actual meaning and purpose of the cross. It took me most of my life to figure out what the cross is about. And it's because, well, the lamb was the one that God took his wrath out on. He was the fall guy that took our place. And I never could love that kind of God, because what if he got into a temper tantrum again in eternity and I might be in the direct path again? But until I believe that God is just like the lamb, I can't trust him. But this beast portrays the lamb as being, well, like most of Christianity portrays him to be.
So is that ultimately, we haven't got to 13:13 where it talks about he performs great miracles, brings fire down, you know, deceives those who live on the earth, ordering that the people should make an image for the beast. When you guys were talking about 13, did you identify the image of the beast? Is that image of the beast ultimately that view of this is what God is like, this is how he functions, he has the authority, so you need to do what he said or be punished?
Yeah, it's in Daniel 3.
That's a reflection of what we saw.
It's a reflection of the beast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
Daniel 3 is the description.
You know, because I grew up, then the image of the beast is, you know, the mark of the beast, and that's all Sunday keeping. Right. And I'm saying, well, this is a reflection of what the Catholic Church did during that 42 months, you know, where they were taking properties and imprisoning people, torturing, killing them. You know, but it's again, you know, which I keep going, it has to be the man of lawlessness when he comes and then he convinces, isn't that part of the deception? Hey, I can do all these miracles, watch me. And this is what God is like. And I will pressure those in positions of power to again use the forces of the state to say, you must do this or else. This is how God operates.
Yeah, we pretty much went the way that he's the representative of the first beast, or the image is the replica of the beast. That's what image making is about.
The wounded beast,
representation. Mm-hmm. Image making is representation in ancient Near Eastern understanding. I have a whole book called The Graven Image that talks about that. And basically, the image to the beast is a mechanism for control.
Mm-hmm.
Because they can't see the beast, but they're going to be able to see the image. And this is in ancient Near Eastern perception. And the image is given breath so that it can speak.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
And of course, the image is the third person in the counterfeit trinity.
Mm-hmm. Third person in the counterfeit trinity. Can you go on?
The purpose of an image in ancient Near Eastern culture was to draw the deity it represented to the people, to control, to give power to the people, and to make sure that they kept that being, that God that they worshipped, appeased, so that they could give offerings to the image. In fact, the image almost had a life of its own. This giving breath to the image is really very Babylonian, because when they created an image, they did a mouth-washing ceremony and a mouth-opening ceremony that gave viability to that image, so that image was the deity itself.
And wasn't that referred to as inspiration, where they had a ritual with the priest that would do their incantations or whatever and literally breathe into the image?
No.
Because I've heard that.
I haven't read that in the literature. And I've read quite a bit about image making in Babylonia. I don't believe they breathed into them. At least I've never read that. But they would open the mouth because they believed that they opened the mouth, the image could breathe. I maybe should do some investigating. I won't have time this coming week is the problem. The thing that is always true about images is that they formed the catalyst between the God and human beings, not in terms of a relationship, but in terms of maintaining their will and their desire to help human beings and at the same time keep them appeased. An image can be a very powerful thing.
It's basically the communicator between the gods and the people, isn't it?
Well, here in Revelation, that seems to be the case.
So the communicator itself is given life.
Right.
And authority, in essence.
And that's, like I say, that's just Babylonian thinking. You know, they can... Remember that some time ago, I brought up the possibility that, and something I've found to be true all over the place, not just in Babylon, but in life, that Satan's whole design is an alter reality. Mm-hmm. Virtual reality is simply part of that design, in my opinion. Right. It's an alter reality. Because he did not like the reality of love.
Isn't that what lies is founded on, an alter reality?
Absolutely.
He's called the
but
father.
He went all the way out. Writing became an alter reality. Law became an alter reality. Economics became an alter reality. Kingship became an alter reality.
Everything in Satan's kingdom is a counterfeit of something that's true, and a counterfeit's only effective if it mimics something that actually has power.
Right. Like Ellen White says, in either Desire of Ages or Patriarchs and Prophets, she says that Satan wanted God's power but not his character.
Right. Mm-hmm. Or the responsibility.
He wants to be the source of identity, but he doesn't love.
No.
But he wants everybody to depend on him as their source for everything. But that's a hierarchical thing. It's a selfish God construct. And then he paints God to be just like himself.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the ultimate alter reality.
Yes, selfishness is the alter, the inside-out reality.
Yeah.
And he insists that the Lamb version of God is surreal and impossible, and it's impractical. Therefore, he even reinvented the whole story of the Lamb's life on earth to fit his paradigm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Satan seems to be one big mutation.
Yeah, you could put it that way. And he created submutations all over the place.
That's it. It spreads.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he does it in such a subtle way. It's not like Teenage Mutant Ninjas, you know, with the the green slop falling all over his sleeves as he goes forth, you know. The subtlety is pretty amazing. I liked what you had said about the comment that was made, I don't know who said it, regarding not wanting each and every aspect of life that makes it life. It makes it creation, you know, literature, history. And things of that nature. He's, you know, trying to change that, obviously. And he's done a very good job if we look at just this recent last few years, you know, especially with the internet and medicine and things of that nature. So he kind of is deceiving himself, is what I was thinking. Yes, he deceives us, but he's deceiving himself because he may be thinking he's getting that power. So people are going along and being led in that way, but it doesn't change the character of God. And here is the patience and the faith of
And
the
I think that's
saints.
why he's seeing the close down of everything coming to a head. And he knows he has just a short time. And this is where he goes into rage and goes after anybody who wants and nourishes and treasures the love of God and spreads it to other people.
I was just thinking about how that he pulls out all the stops, you know, including this idea of trying to imitate the lamb. And that's what I was thinking about regarding the miracles, like the signs. Like maybe he thinks, well, Jesus used signs. I'll just do more. I'll just do greater signs in order to wow. And so he probably thinks that that might be, you know, he'll just do it full force, that this is he is self-deceived in thinking that this is a direction to go.
Like a finale of the fireworks.
Yeah, exactly. It's we'll wow them and get them to think, well, this is what Jesus did. He used all these signs to heal people and mirror, you know, performed, and that's probably got Satan's attention. Like, wow, he's doing all these things while he's on earth here, and I could do it better.
And quote scripture.
Right. To
Oh,
boot.
yeah.
It is interesting that it talks about he performed great miracles. And I think Ellen elaborates on, you know, the healing quality. But it's interesting to me that, you know, he brings fire down from heaven. You know, this is a watch out kind of, I can do this. I can bring it down whenever I want to on whoever I want to. There's that threat element that, you know, I go, oh, that's interesting that there's that combination healing, but I can take people out by this fire, which seems to me what's implied there.
Now, this is, by the way, this beast comes out of the earth that does the miracles.
And the miracles that he gravitates to the most are the violent miracles, like Elijah did, to justify violence.
But it is a way to identify the source because it's not godlike to do what he's going to be doing.
Well, when there's only power. Now, of course, he may heal the sick and appear to raise the dead.
But he won't
And he
allow.
will,
Yeah,
he
but
will,
he will do it, but he will
he
draw
will,
attention to himself.
he, but he will also pretend to love. He will appear as very loving. He will sweet talk. But then when he thinks he has everybody in tow, he will say, now, there are some people who don't line up and you need to kill them.
They're goading. They're a fly in the ointment.
And he says God is very upset, and God will have to execute punishment, and it's your job to carry out these punishments in his name. And that fits perfectly the doctrines that are already being taught. So it reinforces what already people already believe about God. So that confirms this must be the real one.
That's why in Great Controversy, Ellen White makes it very clear at the beginning of her treatment of the Time of Trouble that our only refuge and our only security is found in knowing God.
Exactly.
Yes.
And I'll bet when Satan returns or demonstrates his power, he will not be using phrases like, I don't act alone. I only do what my father has sent me. You will not hear phrases like that.
Yeah, he'll have some, yeah.
That's true.
Because there's no truth in him. It'll be all about what he does. His power will be independent of everything else and everyone else.
It does remind me again that in Revelation, it seems like to me anyway, there's a choice every creature in the universe has to make. And it plays out at the end of the era of Earth's history in the story. You will choose who you're going to trust. And to me, it's the work of the Spirit, or it's the rejection of the work of the Spirit. Because you're going to say, I don't trust love, compassion, goodness, freedom, the fruit of the Spirit, right? I don't trust that. It needs force, fear, intimidation, guilt, and shame. So the only alternative a person has left, if they have shut that work off, is to go towards force, fear, intimidation, and that will be attractive. And so to me, this is every being in the universe will know, and well, at least experience that choice.
And you know, Bill, I grieve for those who have shut that off because they were abused as children. And they can't trust anyone, really, in a sense. I don't say you're wrong at all. I'm just saying I'm humanizing this a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm trying to make it real in terms of our human experience.
Well, this is the question. If everything we've always known, and this is where it goes back to something you said, each of us has a role who trusts this picture of God. But the Spirit, I mean, for me, I don't discount that. I still think the Spirit gets through to everyone in some capacity, even through the most hideous abuse.
Yeah, with some abuse, it gets through and only causes pain. Because the other has been used to, because love has been denied. The true love has been denied. Force, fear, and intimidation is the thing I use to keep myself from pain, being pain, in total pain and feeling terribly vulnerable and terribly, frighteningly likely to be hurt again. I find that is a very real thing. And that's why I want to show compassion to people who have been through that experience and who are exhibiting all the qualities we've been talking about of the beast, because that's been their journey. And I just want to pray for them that somehow they can find that vulnerability is an avenue to experiencing something so much greater than mere power. It's a different kind of power.
I was thinking
it's empowerment rather than power over.
Right.
I was thinking about Revelation 18, where it talks about Jesus' call to come out of her, my people. The idea is that, you know, it's like reminds me of Matthew, where he talks about coming to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, I'll give you rest. So I think there is a message for those who are entrapped within Babylon, you know, to come out and to be healed, you know. So there's a message of compassion for those who are trapped in abuse situations, you know, that we need to be clear and given a clarion call for those people.
And that's a good point. And that's a good answer to you, Bill, from Gene, regarding PTSD people, you know, true love denied, force, fear, and intimidation. So to find that vulnerability is very important. And that's not denying people that have come from PTSD are not suffering and in need. That's a hand that reaches out and says, here. You may be a little bit too trusting, or you may be predisposed to certain things. There's quite a bit more to this conversation, but I like that thought, and I'm going to dwell on that for a little bit, that to find vulnerability as an avenue of empowerment. It's a very profound statement, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
I think the greatest illustration, Jesus said, was the greatest illustration of the superior, even invasive power of the gospel to trump all this damage that the enemy causes through abuse, through shame, through fear of vulnerability, all that stuff we're so familiar with. And yet the gospel, where sin abounds, grace much more abounds. Beyond even our ability to believe that it can happen, just as long as they're willing to accept it. And I think the greatest demonstration of that, according to Jesus, was when one of the worst abused women was washing his feet and choosing to be vulnerable. If she felt compelled to be vulnerable, she couldn't help herself, because this man had done what nobody could ever do, was to win her trust after casting seven demons out. And after who knows how long of living, allowing people to exploit her, maybe out of total necessity or whatever. I mean, everything was against her. And yet here she is in front of beastly men who are despising her and shaming her. And Jesus steps up and defends her. And then he says, makes her an example of the gospel. And then makes a declarative statement saying, wherever the gospel is preached, this is going to be the example. I don't think we've ever taken that seriously. That's why I don't think we're preaching the real gospel, because I don't hear that story talked about. And Jesus said, if you hear the real gospel, that's what's going to come with it.
Yeah, there's another character there standing there as well, correct? Is not Judah?
Judas and Simon.
Judas
both.
With the purse, right? Yeah, intimidation. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep.
And yet we know that Yeshua had all that he needed.
There was the greatest story
from the very
of the
beginning
and the beast.
In creation. Mm-hmm.
The beauty of love and the beast gaping, wanting to destroy this beauty.
That's what I loved about Jesus, or love about Jesus so much, is that he never left anyone without first making them whole. And he did it not just physically, he did it emotionally, spiritually, mentally, every way.
As long as they were willing. And he had Judas. He wasn't.
Yeah, willing. Judas, he couldn't, but he still looked at him with pity. He would have if he could have let him.
He still washed his feet, knowing what was coming next.
So I think the mark of the beast, whether it's the name or the number, resonates with, because it specifically mentions again to worship the beast who had the death wound. And if it appears that he had a death wound, that to me resonates with the word mark, like scar or something. It was like, you look at him and it's obvious, this guy ought to be dead. And so a mark is a unifying brand name or trademark, if you want to say, trademark. Wow, that's an interesting phrase. Trademark. You got commerce in there, don't you? And violence, which is violating people's freedoms and rights. So it's the trademark of the dragon or the beast or whatever you want to call it. And everybody is to take on that brand. And you're given a choice. You can either embrace it wholeheartedly, or you can just go along. But one way or another, everybody's got to have it.
I like trademark. We were talking about slave mark last time. But trademark works with the buying or selling or not being able to buy or sell.
Mm-hmm. A mark of trade.
Mm-hmm.
Slave trading.
And it could include slavery as well.
Right.
So, question, did you conclude that the number was a man, a number of a man, or humanity, or are they the same?
I would say, I think we concluded that it would be a single man who had that number, but it would always cohere with the power structure of that we understood from thinking of it in Babylonian terms.
Mm-hmm.
It's a mark of surrender to power.
Mm.
Or use, abuse of power, and power devoid of love.
Mm.
And where I see that word man linking in very tightly is both in Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, where it specifically says, you claim you're a god, but you are a man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that works, especially, isn't that Isaiah 14?
Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28.
Yeah. Especially in Isaiah 14, because mm-hmm. the man who thinks he's a god is the king of Babylon. And that fits very nicely. But Ezekiel is also very important to Revelation, because when Babylon is talked about, it is identified with all the key elements in Ezekiel 27. That belong to 28 also.
Yeah, Revelation 18 and Ezekiel 27 are like a pair, like twins.
That's what Revelation uses
as
the backdrop.
Yeah.
And do you link that to the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians?
Mm-hmm.
I think so, yeah.
Because that's where my brain goes. It's like, okay, there's, because again, it's man of lawlessness, emphasis on that.
There's no one so lawless who himself is law.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
But wouldn't that be a man who operates outside of God's design laws?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right.
Force, power, coercion, and all the heads of state that he can muster to steer
people. The thing that strikes me is that those who want to lay down the law are a law unto themselves,
mm-hmm.
usually.
Mm-hmm.
And in true love, the law of love is the law of surrender to the other in love.
So, Gene, you were the one that circulated many years ago, wasn't it, that law is the bailing wire?
I got that from a friend, from a colleague of mine, Angel Hernandez. He used to teach with me in the department. He said that law is the bailing wire we use to wrap around and hold together our trust.
Relationships trust. That have no trust.
Relationships. Yeah. Yeah, it's been a while since I've used that, but yeah.
Bailing wire that holds the relationships together where there's no trust.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Hmm. Law
is what we do when we lack love and trust.
Hmm.
Yeah, no longer agreement by handshake. You got to have 500 pages of fine print written by 50 lawyers.
Wait a second. I want to add a codicil to that.
Yeah.
That's why I always had a giggle at the kitchen table. I'm from a big family. I always had a giggle at the kitchen table when my dad would say, I'm laying down the law. I had it. And I just remember my little sister, Sarah, saying, I love you, Daddy. And all the boys in the family would be like, going, yes, Sarah. Yeah. Because my dad's was like, you know, we'll get to that after dessert. You know, lay down that law, Dad.
Sounds like your dad had a soft heart in him.
He did. He did. Unfortunately, he had to work so much with such a big family. But then again, coming up in a Catholic setting, you know, he had rhythm. I'll just put it like that.
Yeah.
And the Lord did provide. Because the Catholics do, the parochial schools do something that's kind of interesting. If you pay for the first few kids to go to school, then the rest are free. Yeah, they had like, you know, they had like these little guidelines, you know. So he was happy to do that. And I think that was, I don't think that was force or fear or intimidation. It was just the carrot, like as you said, Floyd, the carrot in front of the cart kind of thing. So it's the way he rolled. It's the way we rolled.
Well, I think, do you think we've gone an overview enough?
Yeah, we started with the last verse and then we went back and did the rest.
Yeah. So
what does that mean? You were led by the Spirit then?
Actually by a need to recap last week since nobody else was here. We left Floyd and me.
I thought Irma was here.
Irma left before we got really deep into this.
But it was as soon as I finally finish editing it and get it out, then you can get the long version.
But there's something about seeing it in detail.
Yes.
As it happens, that's really reinforcing.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to even go deeper on that a little bit sometime, but yeah, it was.
Uh oh. No.
Well,
Floyd,
you know,
no,
we didn't.
Nope.
We didn't have enough
now
time
when you start
to really
putting footnotes
explore
on
the
stuff,
sky
buddy,
god.
We're going to get 14 pages more for like Revelation 16. And I thought we were done.
Yeah, I got a long history on. Well, we just need a little more.
As you led, brother.
Father in heaven, we thank you for the time that we spent together on a very significant, important chapter of Revelation. We ask that we may always follow the Lamb, that his ways, his love, his self-sacrificing spirit will imbue us, fill our hearts, and enable us to not look out for ourselves, but for others, and for your honor and glory.
Yes, Lord.
We thank you for this. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.